Well, we're beginning tonight a study of Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther. Let's see what kind of range this has. And what's that? Oh, I might have to be up there tonight. That's all right. And we're beginning with an introduction, as we generally do, to kind of get a big picture of the book and what's going on in it. An introduction to Ezra and Nehemiah, and we're looking at them as a single unit because going all the way back to many, many years ago, actually all the way back to the beginning of Ezra and Nehemiah, they were originally considered a single book. They were written as a single book. If you had access to the ancient scrolls, Ezra and Nehemiah would be on the same scroll because they were written together. It's not, in fact, until the Middle Ages when they were kind of separated. Let me go ahead and bring this up here with me, because then I can at least move around a little bit up here. All right. I think I'm situated now. It wasn't until sometime in the Middle Ages that they began to be looked at as distinct books. And if you trace back the history of it, you find that this is the case all the way back to the very beginning, that it was seen as a single book. The Masoretes, for example, the Masoretes, if you're not familiar with them, were a group of Hebrew scribes that did the transcribing of the Old Testament from one copy to the next. And they were very renowned for the accuracy with which they transcribed it. They do things like count words in all the manuscripts to make sure they were all equal, and they'd find the middle verse in one and compare it to the middle verse in the next to make sure they were transcribing accurately the Hebrew Bible. And at the end of each book, they'd make extensive notes about the book that they had just transcribed. And the notes of the Masoretes is at the end of Nehemiah. There's not separate notes at the end of Ezra and Nehemiah. They calculated the middle verse of this single book is Nehemiah 3:32, which clearly couldn't be the center verse of just Nehemiah. It's the center verse of the two of them together. The Septuagint, also the ancient Greek translation of the Old Testament, sees it as a single book. It's a little complicated because the Septuagint also has an apocryphal book of Ezra, which is not in our Bibles. But there is also an Ezra Nehemiah. It's called something else, but it is seen as a single book there as well. And this, I think, is a little bit more important than just interesting trivia to know that it was originally a single book. It does help our understanding of Ezra and Nehemiah together, specifically because of some of the oddities that you find in Ezra and Nehemiah if you're looking at them as individual books. For example, the book of Ezra is not really just about Ezra, and the book of Nehemiah is not really just about Nehemiah. Ezra 1 through 6 is really about Zerubbabel and Jeshua. It's not about Ezra at all. And Nehemiah 8 through 10 is about Ezra. It's not about Nehemiah. And if you're just looking at them as individual books, trying to figure out what on earth is going on with these two books that are supposed to be about these two folks, but suddenly they're about other people for fairly large sections, it could be a little confusing. But when you understand, that's not what it is. It's not two separate books about Ezra and a book about Nehemiah, but it's a larger story of post-exilic reconstruction of Israel. It really helps explain all of that. Also, there's a fairly regular shift in these books between first and third person, which is to say that sometimes Ezra is writing about me and I and what I'm doing, and sometimes all of a sudden it's he and him when it's talking about Ezra. And the same thing happens in the book of Nehemiah as well. Sometimes Nehemiah is writing his own story, and sometimes someone else is writing about Nehemiah, and it helps explain what's going on there to see that these are two parts of a single volume that someone has put together to tell this story of post-exilic reconstruction. Moving forward beyond this, I don't want to dwell on this point too long, it's not that important, is to look at Ezra and Nehemiah in the context of larger history. And I want to look at this from two different perspectives. First of all, I want to look at Ezra and Nehemiah in the context of biblical history and how it fits with what's going on in the story of the Bible. And the first thing that I would point out about Ezra and Nehemiah is that this is the end of Old Testament historical narrative. This is where the story of the Old Testament really stops. Of course, in your Bibles, there's a whole lot after Ezra and Nehemiah. There's Esther, Job, Psalms, Proverbs, etc. But the actual story of the Old Testament, chronologically speaking, ends with Ezra and Nehemiah. And what's so significant about that is that the story does not end with a destination. It does not end with a conclusion. The story of the Old Testament does not end with, and they lived happily ever after, so to speak. It's really more of a stopover, we might call it, than it is a destination. It's just another point in the continuing story of God and God's people, and it invites you to consider further what God has planned and what is going on, not to get to the end of the story and say, oh, that's nice, that's the end of the story, and put it down and leave it aside. Interestingly, the New Testament historical narrative ends much the same way. Incidentally, we're studying the book of Acts right now on Sunday mornings, which is the end of New Testament history. It ends with Paul in prison in Rome, and that's basically where the story of the New Testament ends. And it ends in very much the same way. The narrative just kind of breaks off abruptly. You don't know what happens. It just kind of stops, and it's obvious that there's a journey yet ahead. And it's interesting to me that historically the Bible does not end with an end. It doesn't end with a conclusion. It ends with an open end, which invites you to continue on, and I think is instructive to us that the story of the Bible, the story of God, the story of God's people does not end with the Bible. It is intended to continue on through the generations and ultimately to us as well. Also, in the context of biblical history, Ezra Nehemiah, I think, is something of a second Exodus. Referring back, of course, to the first Exodus, where it all began when Jacob and his small family moved down to the land of Goshen when Joseph was in charge there. And they lived there in the land of Goshen for some four generations. And Israel then became captives. They became slaves to the Egyptians. But a family went in and a nation came out. Something very similar is going on here in the stories of Ezra and Nehemiah. Just like a millennium earlier, they emerged from captivity, but this time, instead of changing from a family to a nation, they've kind of changed back in the other direction. No longer are they a kingdom that they once were, with their kings and their rulers and all of the things that go along with that. Now it's just a little remnant of God's people who are coming back and going back to the place where they had once left captivity to go to, so they are now again. A little bit more complex, that went backwards, is Ezra Nehemiah in the picture of world history. And this is where we're going to take a couple of moments at least to get an idea of what's going on in the world around them. And I ask you to bear with me because we're not studying the Bible for a couple of minutes here as we look at Ezra Nehemiah in the context of world history. But I ask you to bear with me first because I think it's important to understand what's going on in the world at the time that this is going on. And then secondly, because it makes a very strong religious, theological, spiritual, whatever you want to call it, makes a very strong point about God when we get to the end of this. So although it's not directly Bible study, I think it does have something to do with what the Bible teaches. Well, all of this begins, really, with the end of the Babylonian captivity. Babylonian captivity is where the last class left off at the end of Kings. They've been carried off, and the story of Babylonian captivity is taken up in Daniel and Ezekiel and Jeremiah and some of the other prophets. You can read more about that. But we're basically going from the beginning of the captivity to the end of the captivity in one class. And the way the Babylonian captivity ends is with the reign of Nabonidus, who was the last king of Babylon, which may surprise you if you don't know secular history, because you may suspect the last king of Babylon was Belshazzar, who you read about in Daniel chapter 5 as the last king of Babylon. And this is one of the really interesting things that I'll take just a moment to mention. It really doesn't have much to do with our class, except it's fun to poke fun at the unbelievers who mock the Bible and then find egg in their face later on. Belshazzar was one of the great pillars of the Bible being wrong that people used to point to all the time, because for years and years and years, there was no such person as Belshazzar ever mentioned at any point. And everybody said, you see, the Bible was wrong. Daniel didn't know what he was talking about. That whole book of Daniel, it's not some ancient book that has all these prophecies. It was written hundreds of years later, and he just didn't have his facts straight. But it turns out, in fact, that there was a Belshazzar. He was the son of Nabonidus, who was the last king. Nabonidus, interestingly enough, didn't live in Babylon most of the time because he had a little bit of a rift with the priests of the chief god of Babylon. So he kind of lived off in the desert somewhere where it was safe and let his son Belshazzar rule in his stead. And that all fits perfectly with the biblical picture because, as you remember, when Daniel translated the handwriting on the wall, what Belshazzar offered him was the third place in all of the kingdom. Not the second place, because that wasn't his to give, because he was, in fact, second place in the kingdom. Nabonidus was the king, Belshazzar ruled in his stead, and he offered Daniel the third place. But ultimately, archaeologists found what is referred to as the Nabonidus cylinder, which proved the existence of Belshazzar, and suddenly all those people who made fun of the Bible clearly didn't have any idea what they were talking about after all, and it added great validity to the biblical story. Well, that's how Babylonian captivity ended, and that ushered in the Persian Empire. Cyrus was the first king of Persia. After he conquered Babylon, what he decided he was going to do was release an edict in which he promised all of the displaced peoples, all the people that the Babylonians and the Assyrians before them had carried off into captivity and scattered all over the world, he promised all of these peoples the ability to go back to their original countries and promised them the right to rebuild the sanctuaries to their gods, which, of course, in the midst of all of that, allowed the Israelites, the Jewish people, to return back to Palestine and rebuild the temple as well. His son was Cambyses. He was the son of Cyrus. That's funny. He was Cyrus' son and the son of Cyrus. He's the one who extended the reign of the Persian Empire into Egypt, and that becomes important in a couple more minutes, but he extended the borders into Egypt. It was probably late in his reign that Zerubbabel and Jeshua returned back to Palestine. There's another one who fits in here, but he's really a non-figure. His name is Guamata or Pseudo-Smertus, depending on who you ask, and there are a few other names for this guy as well. But basically, he posed as the brother of Cambyses, and Cambyses had actually killed his brother a few years earlier. But he posed as his brother and then showed up, and later Cambyses died under some suspicious circumstances. And this guy took the throne for less than a year. But then Darius, who was one of the military leaders of Cambyses, came along and killed this Guamata fellow, and he took the throne. And he kind of restabilized the Persian Empire after the turmoil that came with the death of Cambyses. But then when the Jewish people were trying to rebuild the temple and they were facing some opposition, the edict of Cyrus was discovered and Darius honored that edict and allowed them to continue to rebuild the temple. His son was Xerxes, who you may know better under his Greek name Ahasuerus, who was the king of the Book of Esther. We don't know much about him outside the Book of Esther and some Greek sources that talk about him, but the trustworthiness of the Greek sources are kind of hard to determine because he was constantly attacking Greece and they really didn't like him. And so if they're the only history we have on the guy, it's kind of hard to say how accurate that may have been. But he really doesn't fit in too much, at least to Ezra and Nehemiah. He fits in more to Esther. But that brings us to his son, who was Artaxerxes. He was the king during the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. During the time of Xerxes, his father, the kingdom, the empire began to really start to unravel a little bit at the seams. Xerxes was something of a fickle and unreliable king, it seems. Things began not being quite so peaceful when he was in charge. And basically the entire reign of Artaxerxes then was spent trying to keep the empire together. And it did continue on past him for a few more generations before the Greeks came in and took over. But there are a couple of very important events that happened during the reign of Artaxerxes that fit back into the biblical story. As you remember, back in Cambyses' reign, they extended the empire to Egypt. However, in 464 to 456, sometime in that range, during the reign of Artaxerxes, Egypt revolted against the Persians. They decided that they were going to fight back against them. They got some help from the Greeks, who were still at odds with the Persians over what Xerxes had been doing. And so they decided they were going to revolt against the Persian Empire. And ultimately, the Persian Empire came down and put him in their place. But the reason that this is significant is because it is right on the heels of this that Artaxerxes decides he's going to try to get some stability in his empire by building up some of the other nations around Egypt. And it is at this point that he sends Ezra down to Judah as a further effort to pacify his Jewish subjects who are right there on the border of Egypt. And basically what he was doing in sending Ezra down there was to create something of a buffer state between Egypt and the Persians. However, during this first revolt, the general of the Persian army that went down there and put the Egyptians in their place and who was acting as governor down there at the time, he was essentially made to be a liar by the king's mother. He had promised the generals of the defeated army release after the war was over. The mother of the king demanded that they be killed, and he wasn't happy with the whole thing, and so he then revolted against Persia as well, and he led a revolt that the Persians and their army could not thwart until he decided on his own that he was done fighting. Ultimately, he was pardoned by the king, and he was enabled to continue his work as governor. But it is at this point that Artaxerxes again decides to try to stabilize the region, especially by appointing governors in the area who he could trust, who were loyal to him. And lo and behold, wouldn't you know it, Nehemiah fits that pattern perfectly. And he's sent down to Palestine at this time to rebuild the wall and to organize the province and to have a loyal subject there in the area. So now to bring all of this back to the story of Ezra and Nehemiah and to put it in a religious context, when you look at all of this, what you find out is that it just so happened that at the very moment that the years of captivity were up, that God decides that Babylonian captivity is over, it's time for the people to go back and become a nation again, it just so happened that at that very time, a ruler arose and an empire arose that took control of the world and control of the Jewish people, and he wanted his subjects to have religious freedom. And a little while later, it just so happened that when the temple repairs were incomplete and opposition stood in the way, that an emperor found the decree of Cyrus, and he was a good enough guy to honor that decree from three or four kings ago, someone who wasn't even in his family line. And then it just so happened that a revolt began in Egypt, which gave the emperor a reason to try to stabilize the region by sending back godly leaders who would rebuild the Jewish nation, and that happened twice. All of this stuff just so happens along the way. And of course, I would imagine that most of us, that's going backwards again, isn't it? Most of us would understand that this is not a coincidence, but what we see happening here in the history of the world is exactly what is said back in Daniel, that the Most High rules the kingdoms of men. And so when you get a picture of Ezra and Nehemiah and how it fits into world history, you see how it's unfolding according to God's plan, how he's in control of the entire situation, and that everything that is happening along the way is happening for the betterment of his people and the betterment of his plan. Barry?
Well, in the context of history, then, when Cyrus comes up with this decree and makes this amazing decision that all of a sudden he's going to let people go back and establish their religious roots, does that, in the world history, does that kind of play into the whole concept or the re-concept of conquering nations? So like when the Greeks go out and they conquer the world, they don't carry everyone into captivity because they got no place to put them. They leave them in their home areas and then they rule them from afar. And that becomes the new model of how bigger empires are established.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about it in those terms, but probably Cyrus is the beginning of that, and the Greeks do it, and then the Romans do it after them, where instead of bringing them all back as prisoners, they rule from afar. Any other questions or comments through the world history portion? Wayne?
If I understand correctly, the Persians were also one of the first empires that didn't send the king out into the front lines on the battle, so to speak.
Yeah.
I mean, did you get Assyria doing that? You had Nebuchadnezzar leading the armies of Babylon. But Cyrus is just sort of and starting this precedence of other Persian kings doing this, commanding their armies from afar, so to speak, and turning them more into local politicians than military leaders.
Some of the first smart kings, we might say. Guy, were you
going to? I was going to say, just to clarify my mind, the Babylonians are the ones who take the Jews off in captivity, but then they're conquered by the Persians, and the Persians are the ones who release.
Yes, yeah. The Assyrians took the northern kingdom away first. The Babylonians took the southern kingdom. And when the Babylonians conquered the Assyrians, they kind of inherited the northern kingdom as well. All right, well, to turn our focus a little bit more to the text of Ezra and Nehemiah, we want to look at, I think, some of the very important teachings that we find in Ezra and Nehemiah as maybe something of an overview of the book before we begin to look at it specifically. And as you might expect, some of the most important teachings in Ezra and Nehemiah have to do with God. It's no surprise, I wouldn't guess to anybody. But some of the things specifically that you find taught in Ezra and Nehemiah about God, you find a great emphasis on the providence of God, as you might imagine just from the picture of world history that we just saw and how that clearly was unraveling the plan of God and His providence. In addition to that, there are some very explicit mentions of God being in control of what's going on. In Ezra and Nehemiah, you don't find any overt miracles. You don't find God coming down and writing on the wall to Cyrus and telling him what to do. But it is very clear that one imperial decision after another is initiated by God in a very quiet way. The book of Ezra begins with that. In the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Lord might be fulfilled, the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdoms and put it in writing, and then you have the proclamation of Cyrus to the Israelites that they could go home and rebuild their temple at that point. And over in chapter 7 and verse 27, blessed be the Lord, the God of our fathers, who put such a thing as this into the heart of the king to beautify the house of the Lord that is in Jerusalem. And then over in Nehemiah in chapter 2, in verse 6, this is right on the heels of Nehemiah looking like he's in dire straits, and the king says, "What do you want?" And he prays to God in verse 4. He makes his request. And the king said to me, the queen sitting beside him, "How long will you be gone and when will you return?" So it pleased the king to send me when I had given him a time. And so Nehemiah prays and he immediately finds a positive response. But not only was it the kings who were being ruled by the providence of God, and not only were their spirits being moved by God, but also the people who were volunteering to return from captivity and go back home and do the work, they were also roused by God. In Ezra chapter 1 and verse 5, "Then rose up the heads of the fathers, houses of Judah and Benjamin, and the priests and the Levites, everyone whose spirit God had stirred up to go to rebuild the house of the Lord that is in Jerusalem." Nehemiah himself was stirred up by God in the same kind of way. Nehemiah chapter 2 and verse 12, "Then I arose in the night, I and a few men with me, and I told no one what my God had put into my heart to do for Jerusalem." And so everybody in some way is being directed by God to accomplish what God wants done, and that's told over and over and over again through these books. In addition to that, we find God working with His people, not only God directing them and leading them and prodding them on in the way that they need to be going. You find the people reaching out to God when they need help in what they're doing, and God responding to them as they continue to work on what they're doing. For example, in Nehemiah chapter 4, we find them working on the wall of the city, and we find a plot against them to stop their work. "When Sanballat and Tobiah and the Arabs and the Ammonites and the Ashdodites heard that the repairs of the walls of Jerusalem were going forward and that the breaches were beginning to be closed, they were very angry, and they all plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem and to cause confusion in it. And we prayed to our God and set a guard as a protection against them day and night." And then down in verse 14, "And I looked and arose and said to the nobles and to the officials and to the rest of the people, 'Do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your homes. When our enemies heard that it was known to us and that God had frustrated their plan, we all returned to the wall, each to his work. And so these people have a plan to try to stop the work that is being done on the wall. Nehemiah and his group, they pray to God about it. Then they set up guards. They try to protect themselves and they go back to work. And ultimately the plan is thwarted because of all of this. And the result at the end of the day is not that Nehemiah had outwitted them, that they come up with a great plan on their own and they decided what they needed to be done so they could overcome this effort to stop them. The result at the end of the day, according to the text, is that God had frustrated their plan. So they pray to God, they do what they can do, and they leave it in His hands, and God works with His people to protect them. Something very similar is found a couple chapters later. The wall is finished in merely 52 days, and in chapter 6 and verse 16, it says, "When all our enemies heard of it, all the nations around us were afraid and fell greatly in their own esteem, for they perceived that this work had been accomplished with the help of our God." Not, we're a bunch of really good workers and we put our minds to it and we prove that you can do anything you set your minds to. They accomplished this because God was with them and God was helping them. And then one other thing that is taught very consistently through Ezra and Nehemiah is the sovereignty of God. Now, this might not be surprising to us as we're reading the Bible, but it may have been surprising at some point, because one of the truths of ancient Near Eastern thinking was the person who wins a war wins because their God is the strongest God. And so what you have in Ezra and Nehemiah is a nation that has been beaten time and time and time and time again, and they're down to just a small little itty-bitty group of a remnant of exiles who are coming back. And if you want to look at anybody in this ancient Near Eastern way of thinking and say, where's the weakest nation in the world? Who has the weakest God of anybody? You'd probably point to a group just like these exiles and say, clearly they don't have a very strong God because look at them. There's nothing to them. But that is the exact opposite of what is taught consistently in these books. Nehemiah chapter 9 and verse 6, for example, "You are the Lord, you alone. You have made heaven, the heaven of heavens, with all their host, the earth and is all that is on it, the seas and all that is in them, and you preserve all of them, and the host of heaven worships you." Back in Ezra chapter 5, and verse 11, this was their reply to us. "We are servants of the God of heaven and earth, and we are rebuilding the house that was built many years ago, which a great king of Israel built and furnished." They refer to Him as the God of heaven and earth, not our local God who rules us, but the God of everybody and of everything. And that's the same way, in a slightly abbreviated form, that's the same way that Cyrus refers to God in chapter 1 and verse 1. It's the same way that Darius refers to God in chapter 6 and verse 2. And then finally in Nehemiah chapter, we'll look at 9:32, we see another description of God. "Now therefore our God, the great, the mighty, and the awesome God who keeps covenant and steadfast love, let not all the hardship that seem little to you that has come upon us, upon our kings, our princes," so forth and so on. So one time after another, when they look at God in Ezra and Nehemiah, they see Him as sovereign and powerful and ruler over everything, in spite of the fact that they've been in captivity, and in spite of the fact that they're just whittled down to a tiny little remnant. They understand who God is, and they've learned the lesson of the captivities, what it all boils down to. And we'll see that moving forward. Guy, did you?
Yeah. I would think that the critics would ridicule the statement here in verse 2 and later derise the statement in chapter 6 when they admit that there's a God in heaven, et cetera. You know, surely they would look down and say, that didn't happen. That these Persian leaders would not have recognized monotheism and would not have, assumption is in the context, recognized God of Israel.
Yeah. I've often wondered what's going through their minds when they say things like that. And even Nebuchadnezzar back in Daniel, after he goes through his experience and acknowledges God, Pharaoh acknowledges God. so forth and so on. And I don't know what the answer to that is. One of the things that is helpful to remember is that the polytheistic mindset is completely different than anything we're accustomed to. And their way of thinking, there's always room on the shelf for one more God. And if you prove that your God is a great God of deliverance, then, hey, we've got a new God of deliverance. We still have our rain God and our sun God and our this God and our that God, but now we have a new God of deliverance too. And so it's entirely possible that they recognize God as a powerful God without adopting a monotheistic mindset as well. I don't know if that's the answer, but that is very much a polytheistic way of thinking about God, that they would readily acknowledge all the great things that God has done without automatically denying all of their gods too. But that's very foreign to our way of thinking. Joe?
Also, I think in these ancient kings, like you mentioned in Egypt and Babylon and wherever, Persia, it would be difficult for us to imagine the arrogance of these guys, because in kingdoms like those in the ancient times, the ruler had absolute authority over everything, and he was not like the leaders we have today, which are subject to, you know, whatever.
And in most of the cases, they were seen as a son of the god, and which really carried with it the idea of being a god himself. That's a good point. Lawson?
Well, the Israelites had this polytheistic idea also.
That's right.
Almighty God was just another god to many of them.
Yeah, they completely bought into the whole thing, which is why when Elijah had the great victory on Mount Carmel, that didn't suddenly solve the problem. It just showed, okay, we have this great God of fire from heaven, or whatever the case may have been. All right, we need to move on because there's a whole lot more in Ezra and Nehemiah that we need to point out. Another important teaching in Ezra and Nehemiah is the remnant. Of course, we looked at them briefly as a second Exodus already. But two of the very key points that comes out of Ezra and Nehemiah when you look at them in the context of a remnant is, first of all, that they show a continuity with historic Israel. They're not coming out as a new nation. They're not coming out as something different. But as the genealogy is introduced there at the beginning of Ezra, in Ezra chapter 2 and verse 2, they are referred to as the people of Israel. There's a constant reminder, a heavy emphasis on the covenant that God had made with them throughout these books. So there is that historic continuity. These are the same people that God made the promise to, lo, these many years ago. And God is continuing His work to them and through them. But then there is also a separation from the taints of heathenism. They finally learned the lesson that they don't need to get mixed up with these idolaters. And there is a real emphasis on remaining separate from them. There is constant reading of the law and teaching of the law. The building of the wall is something of a symbolic parting from this heathenistic way. I stumbled across a great quote that I think summarizes this point really well. I hope no one's offended by me quoting from someone in the pulpit. But it says, "What we see in Ezra and Nehemiah is an Israel cut down almost to the roots, but drawing vitality from its neglected source of nourishment in the Mosaic Law, and already showing signs by its new concern for purity of growing into the Judaism which we meet both for better and for worse in the New Testament." That what we have here is a group of people that has finally turned back to the law. They've been beaten down so much they realize they have nowhere to go but God. And so they turn to the law as they should have done many, many centuries ago, and they're concerned with purity and they're concerned with following it right. And it's the beginning of what you see when you turn to Matthew chapter 1 as the story picks up there. There's also a very important theme in teaching of worship in Ezra and Nehemiah. The altar is the first thing they rebuild when they get back because they realize they haven't been able to offer sacrifices for their sins. And it says there in the text that they fear God because of this. And so they build the altar specifically to solve that problem. And Ezra and Nehemiah are two books that focus extensively on prayer. There are as great of prayers in Ezra and Nehemiah as you find anywhere in the Bible. And there is a wide range of prayers. You find lengthy prayers that are very eloquently spoken, and you find prayers that don't have time for words, yet there they are. You find prayers that are just a sentence at times, and you find just all kinds of things. There's a great example of this in Nehemiah chapter 1 and and in chapter 2, where chapter 1 you find a very lengthy, eloquent prayer where it seems that he's praying this and thinking about it and meditating on it for days, it says in verse 4, and then verses 5 through 11 are the contents of this prayer, which is a lengthy, eloquent prayer. And then in chapter 2, in verse 4, the king said to me, "What are you requesting?" So I prayed to the God of heaven, and I said to the king, and he gives him his answer. He's there talking to the king. He doesn't have time to get on his knees and offer this great prayer. He has to answer the king, but it says he prayed to God. And we don't know what the content of that prayer is, but it's so quick it's not even recorded. And when you look at these two different prayers that are so different, I think it provides us something of a reminder that our responsibility as God's people in prayer is to pray through a matter with tenacity and hard thought and deep involvement, to really work at our prayer life, yet at the same time, God is not dependent on our prayers to accomplish what He wants to accomplish. And there are times when what we need to do is just acknowledge God, acknowledge that He's there, and ask for His help. If that's all we have time to ask for, He knows what the details are. We just need to acknowledge that He's there and we need His help. And there's a time and a place for every kind of prayer, but these two specifically kind of give us a pretty good range of the kinds of prayers that there are. And then there are other times, we don't have time to talk about this right now, but Nehemiah just is going along his everyday life, doing his thing, and he just says, "Remember me, God." Or he says of his enemies, "Remember them, God, for what they've done." And that's all that it is just you're going about your daily life and you know that you need God and you say, "Remember me." And there's a whole lot of great lessons on prayer that we can get out of Ezra and Nehemiah that we'll pick up as we go through the text. And I better stop there. Thanks for your attention.